Roll away the dawn, roll away the dawn, and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed at all? Sweet liberty.
Listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. Today is Wednesday. It is the 14th of September in the year 2005. This is the last night of our weekly, of our broadcast for the week. And, we have a guest with us this evening. I want to begin here with our spiritual message. And this is something I've been saving, and I decided I wanted to share it with you tonight. This happened, and I don't have a date here. It isn't new. It says when Minister Joe Wright was asked to open the new session of the Kansas Senate, everyone was expecting the usual generalities, but this is what they heard. Listen to this, folks. Heavenly Father, we come before you today to ask your forgiveness, to seek your direction and guidance. We know your word says, woe to those who call evil good, but that is exactly what we have done. We have lost our spiritual equilibrium and reversed our values. We've exploited the poor and called it the lottery. We've rewarded laziness and called it welfare. We have killed our unborn and called it choice. We've shot abortionists and called it justifiable. We have neglected to discipline our children and called it building self-esteem. We've abused power and called it politics. We have coveted our neighbor's possessions and called it ambition. We've polluted the air with profanity and pornography and called it freedom of expression. We've ridiculed the time-honored values of our forefathers, and we've called it enlightenment. Search us, Father. Know our hearts today. Cleanse us from every sin and set us free. Amen. The response, it says here, was immediate. A number of legislators walked out during the prayer and protest. In 6 short weeks, Central Christian Church, where Reverend Wright is pastor, logged more than 5,000 phone calls, with only 47 of those responding negatively. The church is now receiving international requests for copies of the prayer from India, Africa, and Korea. Commentator Paul Harvey aired this prayer on his radio program, The Rest of the Story, and received a larger response to this program than any other he's ever aired. With the Lord's help, may this prayer sweep over our nation and wholeheartedly become our desire so that we again can be called one nation under God. And our guest this evening, ladies and gentlemen, is Mike Brown. Mike, thank you so much for being with us on short notice tonight.
Well, thanks for having me, Jackie.
Yeah, well, it's Carla, a friend of mine, folks, and I were talking this late afternoon, and she asked me who was going to be on, and I said nobody, and we got to talking, and she mentioned Mike and the work that he's doing. And it was very intriguing, but it's a lot more than intriguing. What I hope to bring you, I think about you a lot, folks, and what is it that we can do on this broadcast that you will truly benefit from? And I believe that what Mike is going to share with us tonight is a part of that. And, Mike, I have two of my girls are outside, my dogs, and I wonder if you would give our listeners just a brief background and let them know about your website, and I'll be back in about 30 seconds.
Sure.
I have to go let my girls in, honey.
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Website is MikeBrownSolutions.com. That's www.MikeBrownSolutions.com. I've been involved in alternate energy for over 30 years, and by involved, I don't mean research or you know, passing out secondhand information that so many people seem to be so fond of, or glorified opinions. We also refer to that as armchair engineering. I'm the one who put the Fish carburetor back in production in 1981. A couple of years prior to that, I'm the one who taught the Mother Earth News.
Mike, can you talk up just a little bit?
Sure.
Oh, yeah, you were really mumbling there.
Oh, was I?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. In 1979, I authored Brown's Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook. It sold 80,000 copies through the Mother Earth News. I'm the one who taught them how to run their vehicles on ethyl alcohol. I manufactured the old Fish carburetor for 15 years. At present, I manufacture steam engines. So if I tell you something, look, this is the way it works, I'm not repeating an opinion. I've had the experience, been there, done that, bought the T-shirt. So with that being said, one other thing I need to caution you on is that you'll hear a lot of these wonderful stories about this, that, or the other, whether it's a 200-mile-per-gallon carburetor or how feasible hydrogen is or so forth and so on. And some of you know, I may have to rain on your parade a little bit, because the other advantage that I have here is, in addition to having produced a lot of these items, my formal training is in chemistry. So with that said, Jackie, where do you want to go?
Excuse me. I have not had an opportunity to visit your website. I had company stop over this evening, and they left late. I'll tell you what I'm interested in. Well, first of all, Carla said that you actually have the whole history of, you know, the automobiles and the engines and the carburetors and et cetera, but also that people can actually make their own fuel out of corn and wood and et cetera, et cetera. And does your steam engine, is it made, does it run on fuel like that, Mike?
Oh, that's, well, yeah. Actually, any steam engine is going to run on anything that burns, because all you have to do to get a steam engine to operate, or everything else, let's say the thing is in some, you know, decent state of repair, is all you have to do is be able to boil water and then get it to the what's called the steam chest or the valving system of the steam engine. And if the water is hot enough and the pressure is high enough, the steam engine is going to run no matter what you're using to heat the water with. You can use wood, you can use corn cobs, you can use government documents, you can use old tires, you can use, in this part of the country where I'm from in Missouri, you can use pieces of your neighbor's house after a tornado. Anything that burns is going to make a steam engine function. And what everybody's lost sight of, because we, you know, we get away from the simple things, is that when the steam engine in its present configuration, the old D-valve steam engine invented by James Watt in 1784, they didn't have any source of refined fuel. They didn't even know what it was. They basically had to go with whatever was going to burn. The same was pretty close to being true a century later, even though they had discovered crude oil in Pennsylvania around 1857. Today, it's the same technology. In fact, what a lot of the public loses sight of is that 93% of all the power produced in the United States still produced by steam. It's just done in big power plants where they use either coal or nuclear or whatever, but they're still steam engines. They're steam turbines as opposed to steam piston engines. But it's, you know, at one time, almost every farm in America had a steam engine. There were literally millions of them out there. But the government came around during World War II and talked the farmers into giving up their steam engines to be melted down for planes and ships and tanks and guns. Prior to World War II, you not only had a steam engine on every farm in America, you had Chrysler sending cars to New Zealand that set up to run on ethyl alcohol or ethanol. The Philippines were running almost everything they had on ethanol. The Chinese were using vegetable oil. And oddly enough, when the smoke cleared at the end of World War II, everybody was back to using petroleum, which kind of, you know, begs the question, was World War II partly fought to make the world safe for the petroleum industry.
Ah. Well, what about the first cars? What were they running on?
Okay, well, the first vehicle ever built was a monstrosity that weighed about 10 tons.
Okay.
The first automobile was built in France in the late 18th century, and it was run on steam. Your locomotives, obviously, from the time that, the first one was put into commercial service in the early 19th century, all the way up until the last one that ran on coal. It was a piston steam engine in 1947. And, of course, there are places in the world today that locomotives still run on steam. And a lot of steam power out there. Dominican Republic, they run almost all their sugarcane fields with steam engines that were built 100 years ago.
What did they do with these steam engines, Mike?
Okay. The primary use for the steam engine is to produce electric power.
Oh.
Okay. For example, the steam turbines you see in the big power plants today, that's what they're used for. The steam engine itself, if you use it in a locomotive, they last forever. There's a steam locomotive in India that was put into service in 1855, and it's still running today. In other words, they literally last forever.
Let's say today, the price of fuel is astronomical, of course, and we know that this is all contrived and I've got an article here. I cannot recall which company it was, which oil company, one of the big ones, and the CEO is getting ready to retire. And this article, I think it was New York Times, said that the biggest dilemma here is what to do with the $60 billion profit they have, the windfall from the price of oil. So we know that they're not paying higher. We are paying higher. And I'm wondering, okay, for example, the automobiles today, I mean, they cannot run on steam. Is there a way that today's present cars can somehow be converted to run on fuel that people would be able to make themselves?
Well, actually, the steam automobile is a luxury, but yeah, the answer to that question is that farmer's alcohol is the way to go, and it has been for at least the last 100 years, because here's the way this works. The difference between ethanol, okay, that's farmer's alcohol that you make from grain, and gasoline as far as BTU content energy is this. If you have 3 gallons of ethanol, one-third of that fluid is by weight what we call oxidized oxygen. It's oxygen that's not going to burn. 3 gallons of ethanol is the energy equivalent of 2 gallons of gasoline and a gallon of water. Now, what that means is if you want to run, I'll tell you how easy this is to prove. Any of your listeners doubt me here, try this, okay? You can find out tomorrow morning how well this works. If you have a power lawnmower, you know, the kinds you push around, it's got a little needle valve underneath the carburetor, and you use that to adjust the fuel flow. In other words, if you need just a little more gas, you turn the needle out a little bit. Well, if you go down to the local liquor store and buy a pint of 190-proof Everclear, that's an alcohol, it's a grain alcohol, that's 95% alcohol, 5%
water. It's pretty cheap, too, isn't it?
Well, not if you drink it, it's not.
Oh, but compared to, like, if you were saying go buy a bottle of 80-proof vodka or something.
Oh, yeah, that's correct. Yeah, Everclear is basically, for drinking whiskey, it's really considered crap. Okay, anyway. But if you pour it in your lawnmower and then just tweak the needle valve out about a turn and a half and fire it up, sometimes it may take 3 turns, but what you'll find is that if the temperature is over 20 degrees Fahrenheit, your lawnmower is going to crank right up, and the smell you're going to get out the exhaust, it's kind of a sickly sweet smell, is going to tell you immediately that lawnmower is running on ethanol. Now, in order to do that in a vehicle, in a car, it really isn't that much more complicated. In fact, we were building dual fuel units for this purpose back in 1979. All you have to keep in mind is that if you want your car to get from point A to point B and you want to fuel it on ethanol, A, you have to flow 50% more fuel, because remember, one-third of that fuel is the same as trying to burn water, all right? You have, which means that you have to have a bigger opening for the fuel to flow through. B, you're going to have a fiberglass fuel tank, because the metallic oxide that coats the insides of the tanks manufactured in Detroit, alcohol is a solvent. The alcohol will wash the metallic oxide right off the sides of your gas tank and put it into all sorts of places like fuel filters where you don't want it to go, because it'll clog things up. You won't get any fuel to either your fuel injection system or your carburetor. Number three, rather than use the conventional rubber fuel lines, because they're cheap, you want to go to braided steel fuel lines like they use in dragsters, so the ethanol doesn't wind up melting the rubber in your fuel lines. And let me add number four here, is that if you have a carbureted vehicle, you're going to have to go with brass floats, because the alcohol will chew up what are called nitrophil floats. It's a composition, but if you do this, you're going to find that it isn't that much more of a leap to setting up a system where you can flip from gasoline to ethanol, drive around all day on the ethanol, and as long as it's above 20 degrees Fahrenheit, you can get it started. Below that, alcohol, it gets kind of hard to light off. Now, for whatever this is worth, Brazil right now probably has the most advanced automobile ethanol program in the country. In fact, this is only about 2 or 3 years ago, Sao Paulo, Brazil, had a really serious pollution problem, real serious smog problem, and they switched most of the vehicles in that city to ethanol. They no longer have that problem. But that's basically how simple it is. All you have to do is understand that ethanol is a solvent, take steps to where it's not going to clog up your fuel delivery system, deliver 50% more of it, and down the road you go.
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Do you have this in writing, like a book or instructions that people can order, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. If they go to the website, MikeBrownSolutions.com, I wrote the book on how to do all this 26 years ago. It's called Brown's Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook. And then if people want really high-grade ethanol, say 190 proof.
Okay, just stop just for a sec.
Sure.
MikeBrownSolutions.com. Okay, it's all one word, all lowercase.
Correct.
And is it Brown or Browns?
It's Mike Brown Solutions.
Mike Brown Solutions.
Yep. Right.
Okay, just a minute. I'm writing, and I want our listeners to be able to write if they want to. Okay, MikeBrownSolutions.com. And you have a book, and it tells all. Do you know what, Mike? When I very first began being involved, coming awake, if you would, and getting involved, and this has been a tremendous learning curve for me, of course, somebody sent me information very much like what you're talking about today, and I was so intrigued with it. I lived in Illinois, and I lived in a wooded subdevelopment outside of a little town. It was a real rural area, and I was so intrigued. It actually had instructions on how to make a still to, you know, to make the ethanol. Now, do you have that in your book?
Was that the material you saw? That wasn't how to build a junkyard still, was it?
Maybe so. I don't know. It was just, I don't know if it was from a book, but it was photocopied. It didn't look like a book. It looked like several pages, and there were actually diagrams and everything on it.
That sounds an awful lot like somebody took my book and
just
ran a few copies.
Whatever, because, you know, you can make this ethanol from almost anything, can't you?
Well, not almost anything. You have to be careful.
Oh, okay.
There's three main things here, okay? The
first wait, I'm getting us ahead of our show.
Sure.
I want the book.
Okay.
We have a lot of shortwave listeners who don't have the Internet access. And if they're interested in getting your book, rather than having to go to a library to look it up, can we give them an address and The name of the book again is what?
Sure. The first one I wrote is called Brown's Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook.
Brown's Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook.
Right. Yeah. Now the first half of it basically shows you how to do modifications of carburetors and fuel systems in order to switch from gasoline to ethanol or back and forth. The second half shows you how to convert grain, such as corn. You get 2.5 gallons of ethanol out of a bushel of corn, plus you get 18 pounds of cattle feed. And, at that rate, basically, corn has just become competitive with gasoline, but nobody's doing anything about it.
Yeah, well, because a lot of people don't know. Okay, what is the price of this book?
$25.
Okay, now, let me ask you this.
Right.
You have other books.
Yes.
Okay, what I would like you to do, because you can tell them about your books, but what if they were only going to get one? Is this the one you would recommend?
Actually, they'd need to get two.
Okay, they need to get two. Okay,
because the second book shows you how to build a junkyard still.
Oh, okay, build the still.
Well, yeah. The first book will show you how to do everything, but what happened was somebody came by my house in 1981 and said, "I bet you can't do this." And I said, "I bet you I can build a whole distillery for less than $100. And he said, "You're on. If you can do it, I'll pay for it." I said, "Okay." So I built an entire distillery out of a garbage can, a pipe full of rocks, some copper tubing, the back of a toilet, and a bucket. And it worked. It cost me $47.10, but, that was 1981, so it'd probably be a little more expensive right now.
Yeah, uh-huh.
But basically, and you think about this for a minute, okay? I'm talking about anybody, including a 10-year-old, can take these two books and produce ethanol as a motor fuel with less than $100 worth of salvage yard equipment. So the next obvious question is, why is the government promoting all this hydrogen nonsense with million-dollar windmills?
Well, I read an article about a hydrogen car they built, a prototype, and it was from one of the California papers. And the guy who wrote the article was given the car to drive. And it was, it could only get so many miles. But anyway, they said that car cost $1 million. And they to build it, the prototype, right? We believe that, of course. But I was under the impression that, because I've heard about the hydrogen cars, too. A friend of mine has a very close friend who's spent a lot of time over in Japan, and he says that, I think it was this guy, that the cars over in Japan are being run on hydrogen, and that there are automobiles in Washington, D.C., and that there are certain cities that are using hydrogen cars or vehicles, for their transportation. So this is a little, what it is for me, is it's a little bit of a confusion. If you would clear it up, because, okay, let us take this call, okay, Mike?
Sure.
Okay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, don't get pissed off. I just tuned in just now. I want to know where to get the book with the ethanol.
Where we're going to give you the address, Storm.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Does he also have a book on how to make biodiesel?
I don't know. Well, you hang up and he'll answer you.
I see, because he can't hear. Okay.
That's right. Bye. Don't get pissed off. That's because sometimes Storms interrupts our conversations. We're going to give the address. Do you, biodiesel, that's the diesel using, cooking oil and stuff like that for diesel engines? Is that what he was talking about?
Yeah, that's what he's talking about, but that's not practical, because if a lot of people go to using it, there's not enough of it.
There isn't enough of it.
However, okay, I'm glad he asked the question, because one of the chapters in my Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook shows you how to turn soybeans into diesel fuel. If you can boil water, you can do it. It's actually simpler than making alcohol. And you're going to get about a gallon of diesel fuel out of each bushel of soybeans. And what you're going to have left over is a very high-quality cattle feed. But that's a chapter in the book.
Yeah, but, well, okay, I'm just thinking of people who live in cities and stuff that would like to do this. I guess, Where do you get the soybeans? And let me ask you this. Are Monsanto's Roundup Ready soybeans, do you know if they're able, if you could make diesel fuel from them? I mean, it's a whole genetically modified plant.
Well, it really doesn't make any difference.
Doesn't it?
Because a diesel engine doesn't care whether the soybean was genetically modified or not. If people or animals are eating it, the odds are the mineral content is unbalanced. But diesel engines don't really care.
Okay. Okay, so the books. There's Brown's Alcohol...
Motor Fuel Cookbook.
Motor Fuel Cookbook.
Yeah, that shows you how to modify fuel systems and turn corn into ethanol.
Okay.
Then the successor to that is How to Build a Junkyard Still. You can build an entire distillery for less than $100 of salvage yard parts. And you know, as soon as you'll turn me loose here, I'll unconfuse you on hydrogen.
Okay, good. But we'll give your address first, okay? Because
sure. Yeah.
I don't want to lose our train of thought.
Okay, yeah. Well, let me also point out the Junkyard Still book is 15. You get both of them for 40. Address is Mike Brown, Post Office.
Wait a minute now.
Sure.
I'm going to write, and we want time for our listeners to write it down.
Sure.
Mike Brown,
right.
P.O. Box.
4884.
4884.
Right. And that's Springfield, Missouri, M-O, and the zip is 65808.
65808. Mike right. Brown, P.O. Box, 4884, Springfield, Missouri, 65808. The first book is 25, the other one's 15.
Right.
Both of them are 40. You don't give a $5 discount if they order both?
No.
Okay.
No.
So 40 bucks for the two books. And is that include the shipping, the posting?
Yes, it does. Yeah, shipping and handling.
Okay.
If they send 40 bucks and if they actually, you know, pay attention, which I'm sure most of your readers will, they'll find in about just a day or two, they'll actually be able to produce ethanol. It's not going to.
Well, you know that thing I read a long time ago. I actually understood it.
Well, you're
and I don't have a mechanical mind or technical mind per se, and I actually understood it. And it would be real interesting. I'll get off that, but I'll bet it was yours, Mike.
Well, quite possibly, because as in 1979 and 1981. I was the only one out there who had anything.
Okay.
I mean, there just wasn't anything else out there, and I don't know, because I sure looked hard enough, and I had to do everything by trial and error,
uh-huh.
And, you know, basically go talk to people, and I literally had to start from scratch.
Well, I want to, we're just about to take our half-hour break here, and so I want to give the address once again. The two books, folks, Mike Brown's Motor Fuel Cookbook, right, Mike?
Alcohol Motor Fuel Cookbook.
Alcohol Motor Fuel
right.
Cookbook. And that's $25. And then the second one is How to Build the Still.
How to build a Junkyard Still.
A Junkyard Still, okay. And that's $15.
Right.
And it's Mike Brown at P.O. Box 4884, Springfield, Missouri, 65808. Let me ask you this. Do you have do you give your phone number out in case somebody...
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, here you go. This is my ex. She's actually the one who runs the orders and all that.
Okay.
It's 417...
Uh-huh.
890...
Uh-huh.
8636.
8636.
Yeah, somebody wants to call up Hammer a credit card.
Oh, you do take credit cards.
She does, yeah.
Oh, she does. Okay.
Yeah, she's actually in charge of
all right, if you wanted to call in, folks, it's 417. I mean, call for it and use a credit card. 417-890-8636.
Right.
We're talking to Mike Brown tonight. His website is mikebrownsolutions.com. And we will be back right after this break. And I hope you've got your pen in your hand and remember that this broadcast, ladies and gentlemen, is brought to you by you, our listeners. We'll be right back.
Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
If you read the history books, the most often asked question to Southerners was this: why did you fight? And the most often given answer is, because you're here. In other words, the South did not invade the North invaded the South.
Was it the Civil War or War of Federal Aggression? John Weaver sets the record straight in this DVD series on the Civil War and the Right of Succession from the Old Paths Christian History Conference. Was there a war to set the slaves free, or was it a war to enslave us all? Get this DVD and judge for yourself. War of Federal Aggression. Get this DVD presentation for a donation of $25 from FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Order online today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Call 559-781-3773. The truth seems strange only because we've been indoctrinated with a fiction. War of Federal Aggression. Get it today.
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back with you with Mike Brown. Mike, we have a caller here. I have a question for you, but I'll wait till our caller asks his question, okay?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, hi, Mike. How's it going today?
Pretty good.
Pretty good, he said, Jerry.
Great. I was just wondering, that he was giving information on how to build a junkyard still and so forth.
Yep.
But that's all great and stuff, but what about if you're, you know, if you're driving from coast to coast, it's not real practical to, you know, to fire up your junkyard still and, you know, make a batch of corn alcohol and dump it in your tank. Does he have any techniques of, you know, increasing your mile per gallon
yeah.
on the present junk fuel that they're trying to sell us right now? Or?
Okay. You want to hang up and hear his answer, Jerry?
Yeah, I could do that.
You won't be able to hear him, honey.
Okay, I'll hang up.
Yeah, I'm Rube Goldberg here, and you can't hear him. He can hear you.
Okay, good talking to you, Jerry.
You too, Jerry.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, good question.
Very good question.
Okay, now, number one. Yeah, he's right. You can't fire up your junkyard still along the road. However, here's what you can do. You can look for in the yellow pages for any halfway decent-sized city. You look under chemical companies. You pick up a telephone, and you tell them, I need ethanol, okay? And they'll ask you, do you want it in a 5-gallon bucket? Do you want it in a 55-gallon drum? Should we bring it to you in a 6,000-gallon tanker truck? Ethanol is the most common industrial solvent in the United States.
Wow.
Only thing that we use more of is water. And in any halfway decent-sized town in the United States that has a chemical company, they've got ethanol in stock, and they'll not only have it in stock, they'll have it in stock when nobody can get gasoline. Does that answer the first part of his question?
Oh, that's the first part, yes.
Okay, now here's the second part. He asks if there's any way to extend fuel economy. Okay, here's one of my favorites. Jackie, have you ever heard the urban legend about the person who went in and bought a new car? And you want to take that?
Caller, will you hold on while he's answering the last question? Hello? Hello, you're on the air.
Well, I don't know. Nobody was there, Mike.
Oh, well, okay.
Go ahead.
Anyway, have you ever heard this urban legend about somebody goes and buys a brand new car, and it gets 50% better gas mileage than anything they've ever had, runs like a scalded dog. They take it back to the dealer, all right, for servicing. Dealer says, you know, we're going to need it about 3 days. And the person gets the car back, and it no longer gets the fuel economy that it did, and it doesn't run as well either. Have you ever heard that story?
No.
Okay, well, I guarantee you some of your listeners have, okay?
Now, you're saying they take it in. Why do they take it in?
For servicing. If it's a brand new car,
you have to take it in
for servicing.
Okay.
Now, this story has been around for generations, okay? And the common wisdom is that they had some kind of super secret carburetor that when they, you know, they brought it back to the dealer took the carburetor off, replaced it with a normal carburetor, and away the person went. Okay? Now, here's the irony. It wasn't a carburetor, but the stories are true. Okay, and here's why. And this is gonna, you know, this is gonna take about a minute or two. I hope, you know, I don't put your listeners to sleep while I explain this.
I doubt you will, Mike.
I will?
I doubt you will.
Oh, okay.
Did you think I said you will?
Yeah, huh?
No.
That's what I heard.
No.
Anyway. Okay. Internal combustion engine, all right, just imagine a tube. You have a piston goes up inside the tube, all right? You have two valves, one for intake, one for exhaust, okay? Intake valve allows the fuel and air in, then it closes. The piston goes to the top of the combustion chamber, compresses the fuel, spark plug lights it off, piston goes back down, and when the piston goes back up, the exhaust valve opens and all the burnt gases come out, okay? Now, the device that controls the intake valves, I'm sure, you know, most of your male listeners are going to know this already, okay, but I'm trying to make this as simple as possible.
Oh, please do, because we have female listeners, including me.
Okay, that's why I'm trying to say.
The device that
determines when the valves open and close is called a camshaft, okay? Now, here's the problem. Let's say that you put pistons instead of the normal 8-to-1 compression ratio. In other words, the piston is down at the bottom of the cylinder. If it has an 8-to-1 compression, it travels up 8 inches, and there's an inch left over, that's 8-to-1. Okay? Now, here's your problem. The more compression you have, the better mileage you get. But at a certain point where the compression ratio reaches right around 13-to-1, you get what's called spontaneous detonation. In other words, you don't even need a spark plug. The heat and pressure is going to become so great that the fuel's going to light off, and that can get really embarrassing if the piston's only partway up the cylinder. Okay, now the engine will shake itself to pieces like that. So here's what they have done, and, well, anyway, I had a friend who was flying weed out of Jamaica that spent all the money he made hauling dope on this engineering project. But anyway, here's the way this works. The standard camshaft, all the lobes look the same. The lobes are what govern when the valves open and close. Now, if you rearrange this engine, here you're talking an engine, standard 8-to-1 compression, actually 8 1/4 nowadays, all right? If you double the compression, you increase your fuel economy by 50%. But you can't do that because the engine will shake itself to pieces. Now, what this engineer friend of mine did, what he figured out was that if he left the intake valve open halfway through the compression stroke and opened the exhaust valve when the piston was almost at bottom dead center, he had 8-to-1 compression, 16-to-1 expansion, and his theory was that a spark ignition engine, a gasoline engine, would have the same fuel efficiency as a diesel. Well, he was correct, because we actually built some of these engines, and they even sounded like diesels. The first one we ever built, we put in a 72 Chevrolet truck, and our mileage went from 15 to 22.5 immediately, and when you stepped on the gas, this thing would become self-supercharging around 4,000 RPM, and it would throw you back in the seat. Okay?
Sounds like my 65 GTO.
There you go. Okay. anyway, my buddy's name was Larry Pindell, and Larry told me when we were working on this project back in the mid-'80s, he kept saying, you know, Brown, this is too simple. Somebody has already done this. So we sold a few of the camshafts for these things, and they had to go buy their own 16-to-1 compression pistons. And people actually did get these kind of results, but this was back in the mid-'80s, and, you know, nobody really cared.
Yeah, and the gas wasn't so high.
Right, precisely, okay. And sure enough, one of the people that we were dealing with down in San Diego sent me an engineering, automotive engineering handbook from 1909. Had the exact same system in it. In other words, basically all you're doing is 8-to-1 compression, 16-to-1 expansion, and you literally increase your fuel economy by 50%. In other words, all the gasoline-powered vehicles out there that don't have this system, which of course is all of them, are wasting one-third of their fuel.
Wow.
So
on purpose. I say on purpose. But what has this got to do with the story you told about you've got a car that runs like great and it gets great fuel mileage, you take it in for service, you bring it back, and you're not getting the same mileage? How does this relate to that?
Because what they were doing, the automotive industry, every once in a while they let one of these engines get loose, and when they located it in the dealership, the dealer would get the vehicle back, pull that engine out of it, and put a normal engine back in. That's what's been happening.
Let me ask you a question.
Pardon?
Do you think, I was told, in fact, a friend who worked in one of the factories in Flint, Michigan, he said when one of the executives orders a car, that it's tagged while it's going through the line, and everything on that car is perfect. You know, no fluff off anything. Do you think that that's what they do for special people?
No, I think the story that I'm telling you, I think basically the guys back, you know, the gearheads back in the engineering department,
yeah,
they just put one of these things together, and then somebody sticks it in the car, and then they realize, oops, you know, this thing got out of here, we've got to retrieve it. Okay. But it's something that's happened over and over, because other people keep coming up with the same principle. Problem that you have with the automotive industry when you start talking about something like this is that the banks and the oil companies all own automotive industry stock.
Yeah.
And the oil company does not want to see its sales go down by a third simply because these engines would be built the way they should be built for maximum fuel efficiency instead of what we've got.
So the answer to Jerry's question is what you just said.
Precisely.
So let me ask you this.
Sure.
Somebody listening to this maybe hears it and understands it, but do you have anything in writing with this type of instruction on it that people can get, or is it in one of your books?
Well, in the epilogue to the Fish Carburetor book, I manufactured the old Fish Carburetor from 1981 to 1996. We made about 10,000 of them. We finally threw in the towel because everybody went to fuel injection. But yeah, all the principles I'm describing, not the exact timing, because I've got an exclusive with Crane Cams on this particular grind, so we don't just give it away. But as far as the principles go, it's in the epilogue to the Fish Carburetor book that I sell for like $15.
And what is that? How to build a fish carburetor?
No, it's basically how they work, because see, all conventional carburetors,
because I don't know what a fish carburetor is, but maybe some of our listeners do.
Okay, well, it was a carburetor invented by a man named John Robert Fish.
Okay.
In fact, before I go there, you and I were talking off the air, I'd like to bring this up, because you know, we were talking about how the automotive industry does so many things wrong, and I know you were saying it was deliberate, but what I'm saying is a lot of times it's just plain stupidity.
Yeah.
Or lack of attention to detail. Let me give you an example. In 1888, Daimler built the first carburetor. And
Daimler?
It was an updraft. In other words, the fuel and air had to flow up into the intake manifold. And this went on for about 40 years until 1930. And the reason that they built these carburetors up, what we today would consider upside down, is for 40 years, everybody made the assumption that gasoline vapor, like other vapors, rises. But it doesn't. It falls. And that's why from 1930 till a carburetor came to its untimely end in the early 1980s, all carburetors then were built as downdrafts. In other words, the fuel and air went down, not up. Now, here's an entire industry that for 40 years, nobody noticed anything as simple as the fact that gasoline vapor doesn't rise, it falls. You'd think somebody would have noticed.
I'm having a problem grasping that because I'm thinking about a gas tank.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying the vapors are all beneath the gas?
No. What I'm saying is that if you put gasoline vapor, all right, in a situation where the vapor, not the liquid, okay, but where the vapor will rise or fall,
uh-huh.
It will fall.
Okay.
Okay, in other words, it actually is pulled down towards the earth. That's one of the reasons that we don't really have a whole bunch of leaking gas tanks out there, is because the gasoline vapor doesn't rise and then go around the screw threads in your gas cap, because if gasoline vapor rose, you know, you'd have people driving down the road leaking gasoline vapor all over the place. But it doesn't work like that.
Okay. Okay. Why don't you give your address one more time? Because I have these two girls here panting to go out again. I'm sorry about this interruption.
Okay, sure.
I've got nobody else here, Mike.
Sure, I understand. It's www.mikebrownsolutions.com, and the mailing address is Mike Brown, Post Office Box 4884, Springfield, Missouri 65808. And the other thing I'd like to touch on here, I don't know if we're going to have enough time, is hydrogen. Because a lot of people are saying, all right, well, you know, this is the way to go. Let me give you the first problem with hydrogen here, and it's this.
I'm listening now.
Excellent, okay. Gasoline has 120,000 BTUs per gallon. Ethanol has 80,000 BTUs per gallon. Now, the way this works out in real life is that, as I pointed out before, that you're only going to go two-thirds as far on a gallon of ethanol as you are on a gallon of gasoline. Problem with hydrogen is, and this is only one of the problems, is that it has 30,000 BTUs per gallon. Now, in the real world, here's what this means. If you're getting 16 miles per gallon with 120,000 BTUs in a gallon of gasoline, you're only going to get 4 miles per gallon in 30,000 BTUs of hydrogen.
That's what this guy in this article was talking about, I think, because he couldn't go very far. He would drive to a certain place and back again, and he was watching the fuel gauge, and it was going down very quickly, and that makes a lot of sense. In other words, what he was saying in this article, it isn't very practical.
Well, it's even less practical than you think, because let me give you some other problems with hydrogen, all right? One of the other things you're going to run into is hydrogen is the smallest molecule in the universe. It leaks. It will leak out your gas cap if that's the way you're storing it. It will leak past piston rings. It will leak past valve guides. I mean, it just leaks. And so what winds up happening is not only can you only theoretically go a fourth as far, but you've got a molecule that is so tiny that it just leaks out of every possible place that it can leak from.
Well, what if you had some kind of an engine that you could put water in your tank to create the hydrogen? Then you could just keep filling it up with water, couldn't you?
No, it doesn't work like that.
Okay.
Because water is hydrogen and oxygen with the energy removed.
Okay.
Now, in order to burn either hydrogen or oxygen, it has to be diatomic. In other words, it either has to be H2 or O2. But that isn't the way the water molecule is constructed. Water is one hydrogen atom attached to one oxygen atom attached to another hydrogen atom. Because if you could burn water, the whole planet would burn up. The planet's three-fourths water. It doesn't work like that. And the other problem you're going to have is you hear all these people talking about, well, we can do this with electrolysis. You know, we'll just put positive and negative leads into a bucket of water, and we'll use a windmill and so forth and so on, and we'll get the hydrogen out that way. Well, sure you will, but here's one of your problems, is that H2, which is the only kind of hydrogen you can use as a fuel, the hydrogen in water is only 11% by weight of the fluid. In other words, you're going to spend 89% of your effort
putting water,
getting oxygen.
Okay, we have a caller here.
Sure.
Thank you, Mike.
Jackie, first of all, you sounded a little miffed when Mike was talking about gasoline vapor being basically what it is. It's heavier than air. In other words, if you mix it in with air, it will settle to the bottom.
Okay, thank you.
As opposed to, let's say, hydrogen, which is lighter than air. That's why you have dirigibles can fly. But if you fill a dirigible with gasoline vapor, it'll actually sink.
Okay, thank you.
So that's what you're talking about.
Thank you. Who's calling?
This is Bob from Texas.
Hi, Bob.
I used to work for Southwest Research in San Antonio. We were one of the leading fuel and lubricant research and development facilities in the United States. We're very well known. And we explored all types of fuels. And here's the problem that we found with alcohol. You can never, well, I won't say you can never. It takes an extreme amount of energy to get 100% alcohol. And this just has to do with chemistry, the nature of chemistry. Now, you can get it 90% and 10% water, but the 10% water causes a tremendous amount of damage and corrosion and a lot of other problems with timing and other issues, and that's the principal reason that larger vehicles do not operate very efficiently with alcohol. Now, Brazil, for example, has very small vehicles, 500cc engines that run very well off alcohol, as Mike mentioned, the amount of BTUs. But you can't have an Explorer or the type of cars that Americans want to drive and have them run effectively off alcohol. So
yeah.
That's all I have to say.
Bob, thank you. You know, the thought that occurred to me, though, when you said that, we're talking to people who aren't necessarily interested in a particular type, like something like a, you know, hot car or whatever, but people...
Just basic transportation.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, agree. No.
It's coming down to that, isn't it, Bob?
No, I agree, but they would have to get used to, you know, much smaller vehicles.
Yeah, I've got a little Beretta here, and I've had it for 15 years, and it just does beautifully.
Oh, yeah, they're
but I have a feeling that the people you're talking about aren't even listening to this broadcast.
No, of course.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye.
Okay, do you want to comment on that, Mike?
Yes, please. I'd like to make two comments, okay? In the first place...
You know, I didn't write down what research company. Did you catch
it? No, I didn't catch
it. Okay.
I didn't catch that either, but here's what we did, and this is on the website. You can go to the website and see the unit that we built. We built a dual fuel unit back in 1979. It was push button, and you pulled a lever that you could go from gasoline to alcohol. It was a 2.5-ton Chevy Suburban. This thing would go down the road at 95 miles an hour on gasoline. When we switched to ethanol, I got up to 135 and lost my nerve. Okay? Now, and this is one of the things you're going to, you know, you'll read in the Junkyard Steel book. When our Marines captured the airfield, the Japanese airfield at Guadalcanal during World War II, now one of the things we were not able to figure out in the first few months of the war is how the Japanese Zero could outrun, outclimb, outmaneuver, outfly everything we had. And when the Marines opened drums marked aviation fuel there at what later became known as Henderson Field, the Japanese aviation fuel was ethyl alcohol. In other words, the Japanese were running a copy of a nine-cylinder Pratt & Whitney radial engine. I mean, basically, they just copied it.
But maybe, you know, what Bob said is that it takes, you know, to make it from a still, it takes an extreme amount of energy to get 100% alcohol, and maybe that's what he was referring to, and maybe these airplanes were literally running on 100% alcohol.
No, actually, what... And he's right. It does take twice as much energy to go from like 190 proof to 200 proof.
Yeah.
But in the years we ran this vehicle with fiberglass fuel tanks braided steel fuel lines, you know, copper floats for the carburetors and all that, we never had any corrosion problems. In other words, it's really
well, you already talked about the parts that would have to be replaced.
Right.
That, you know, the ethanol, because it's a solvent, would be able to destroy. And so, you know, we're out of our hour. And I'm thinking maybe you'll have to come back with us again sometime.
Wouldn't bother me a bit.
Oh, that would be great. I think our listeners would really appreciate it, Mike. Folks, we've just got a few minutes left. Okay, here we go. We've got a couple of minutes, caller.
Yeah, I just want to ask them. I have a 1985 Audi 5000S, a five-cylinder.
Okay.
I want to know if this will, you know, if the stuff you got in the book will run on this.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, of course it will if it's a spark ignition engine.
He said he Storm probably wasn't back onto the listening again. He said, of course it will, Storm, if it's a what did you say, Mike?
It's a spark ignition engine.
Yeah, okay. Now, Are you saying that my little Beretta, I could fill it up with ethanol?
As long as you can flow 50% more ethanol than you're flowing with gasoline at the moment, absolutely.
I don't know what that means. What did you just say?
Okay. You have to be able to get 50% more fuel through the opening that delivers the fuel into your
engine. In other words, the modifications would have to be made.
Well, there's only one modification, actually, if you just want it to work immediately. Everything else is just to make sure that it keeps working. Basically, just like I told you, the experiment with a lawnmower, you know, a bottle of Everclear and a lawnmower with an adjustable needle valve, it'll even work on a Harley-Davidson. All you have to do is...
I've got a bottle of Everclear here. I was going to make perfume, and they said to buy, to use 80 proof vodka.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too expensive, so I thought, well, hell, I'll just get Everclear. And it turned what I was trying to make into.
Do you have a power lawnmower?
Yes, I do.
Okay, and then go out there and empty it.
Yeah.
Pour the Everclear in it.
All right.
Turn the needle valve out like half a turn at a time and keep cranking.
I don't know what you mean, the needle valve.
There's a little needle valve. It's like a screw that goes into your carburetor.
Uh-huh.
All right. Maybe a neighbor point it out to you.
Okay, needle valve.
Roll away the dough.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to firstamendmentradio.com.
The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests, and not necessarily those of the First Amendment Radio Network or its affiliated